Okay. Tonight is Lag BaOmer, the Yahrzeit of. Hello, anyone listening? The Yahrzeit of. Mishirim Baruch Hai. Anyone know who else was Niftar? Noted. Who else was Niftar or Lag BaOmer? A great rabbi named Rabbi Moshe. Some of you were at his kever a few weeks ago. Some of you will be at his kever in a few weeks. The Rama was Niftar on Lag BaOmer as well. 1572, 1573, some debate exactly when he was Niftar. So before we start Lag BaOmer festivities and events, don't forget that in Krakow, there's always a pilgrimage to the Ramah's Kever. It's a very special day for the Ramah. But I think it's Rav Eliashiv, one of the former heads of basically the yeshiva, the yeshivish Lithuanian Torah world in Israel, who once berated his students who were planning a trip to Meron on Lag BaOmer, saying, if you want to meet Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, just open a Gemara. Now, don't take that as discounting. For some people, the trip is very valuable and meaningful. Our minhag is not necessarily, they maybe close the door. Our minhag is not to make the trip. But I figured it may be a nice opportunity just to study some of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's well-known statements about Torah, about Eretz Yisrael, about Olam Haba. So that even when you're dancing around the bonfire tonight and you're singing Bar Yochai, you'll at least have some reference point, who he was, what he stood for. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai was a Talmud of Rabbi Akiva. He learned for about 12 or 13 years in Bnei Brak. Sometimes I know a lot of American boys are leaving, and we're trying to speak with them, should they stay a second year? You guys will have that drama in November, should you stay Shana Bet or not stay Shana Bet? Spoiler alert, you should stay. But aside from all that, the conversation, I think to myself, what our grandparents and great-grandparents must be thinking in Shemayim, that they dedicated 15 years to being a yeshiva. I've been doing a lot of speaking over the last couple of weeks associated with Rav Lichtenstein's Yahrzeit. And I had this chus, I wasn't sitting in his chair, but I've really supposed to be with my Rebbe for 32 years. That makes a difference in your life. I can't say I can stay Shana Lamed Beis, but unfortunately, that relationship factor of being with people, whether it's one specific person or being the Beis Hashem, and those of you who have the opportunity, not just that we've converted the experience to a mass movement, into an event, into one of the phrases I think people use in Western civilization. I'm not sure if it's used in Australia and South Africa, but it's certainly very, very preponderant in the North America, is the gap year. I hate that phrase. The phrase is very beneficial because it's turned it into a mass movement, and the gap year has been extolled and proven to be valuable even in non-religious sectors. All the colleges now are encouraging high school students take a year off public service, travel the world, come back a little more mature. But anytime you affix something so different and transcendent and encounter the Kodesh Baruch Hu to a common fad, you dilute it, you diminish its value, you sap its religious energy. So everything has a double-edged sword. I'm happy it's being called a gap year, and I'm happy so many people are drawing attention to it. Unfortunately, it also suggests a limitation of only 1 year, which sometimes it's sad to feel. Those boys have more opportunity. Anyway, so he spent 12 or 13 years learning with his Rebbe, Rabbi Akiva, in Bnei Brak. You may know the very famous Maisha Shai Vesim in Bnei Brak. So Rabbi Akiva had a yeshiva in Bnei Brak, which he taught Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. His illustrious Talmud, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai had many Talmudim, but Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's illustrious Talmud was none other than Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, who authored the Mishnah. So just to help you place him in our Masara, he studied with Rabbi Akiva. He was probably Rabbi Akiva's most dedicated Talmud, to the point that he became what we would call a Talmud Chaver, where he could actually argue with his Rebbe. He was at that, it was close enough in age, evidently. So at a certain point, they almost became colleagues. He taught Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi in a very interesting place, in Tekoa. So today we're celebrating, some of you may have been present at the dedication of the back porch to some of the heroes who fought in 47 and 48. So they talked a little bit about their honor and their defending Rishon Lezion. So keep in mind that this is a very important place during that period. There's a yeshiva in Tekoa. Some of you may know there's a yeshiva in Tekoa, about 25, maybe half an hour from here, part of the Gush settlement block. We're talking tonight on Lag BaOmer about Rabbi Akiva's Talmidim's death. And that's why we mark and experience Sfiras Omer and we engage in mourning. Some people claim that it wasn't just a supernatural death, but these were 22,000 students who were killed in the Bar Kokhba rebellion. Even if it wasn't, even if they weren't overlapping incidents, certainly that was a very traumatic experience to try to rebel and repel the Roman authority, one that failed, and we'll see later, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai certainly suffered part of that, being condemned to a cave for 13 years. But keep in mind, a lot of the merit of Bar Kokhba took place here as well. You're sitting in a very important place in history, but certainly during this period of the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, the evolution of the Tanayim, the rebellion against Rome, Bar Kokhba's failed rebellion. So this is Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, and many people know him as the miracle worker the Gemara talks about. Certainly in the end of his life, he was known as someone who was Meluban Shebenisim. He knew how to do miracles, and whenever there were Gzeros, you have to remember there were tremendous, terrible decrees constantly being issued against the Jews by the Romans. This was real discrimination, real persecution, sometimes physical, more often than not legal, really trying to subdue and to suppress the Jewish spirit. And Rabbi Akiva was one of the people who would regularly visit Rome to try to diplomatically argue against these decrees. Shimon Bar Yochai was sent, in some cases, to work on the supernatural side, not just to diplomatically try to engage with the Romans in negotiations, but to try to repeal some of them. So that's where Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai slipstreams into the Masara. Let's take a look at some of his statements. Probably his most, well, they're all pretty famous, but let's just read a few of them. One of them comes in Brachos. I didn't number them, but you can just follow the paragraphs. Tanya, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai Omer, Shalosh Matanos Tavos, Nasan HaKadosh Baruch Hu LeYisrael, V'chulon Lo Nitnu Ela Yedei Yisurin. So Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai creates a parallel between Torah, Eretz Yisrael, and Olam Haba. Well, everyone knows that Olam Haba can only be achieved through struggle. This is not a world of ease. This is not a world of convenience. This is a world of challenge and struggle and highs and lows and ups and downs and frustrations and tragedy and pain and disappointment and darkness and moral failure. But it's also a world to work so that you'll enter the, so we were talking about yesterday, when you enter the palace. This is a Perel's door. This is a corridor. And in everyone's imagination, that hierarchy between Olam Haba and Olam Hazeh has to be maintained. I remember of Lichtenstein, as if it were yesterday, his voice discussing this Chazal with us. And I'll tell you what he told us. He's, whose computer is making maybe it's one. Is it this maybe? Is someone going to leave it here? No? Yeah. Whose is this? Okay. I'll just turn it off. I think this is making the sound. Okay. So the Chazal tell us that this is a entranceway, Prozdor, mm-hmm. and you should prepare yourself in the entranceway so that you enter the Trachlan, the palace. That hierarchy is incontrovertible. As much as you feel you should or should not engage in this world, as much value as you attach or assign to this world, it's temporary, it's transient, it's secondary, it serves entry to the next world. Some people, because of that hierarchy, disengage entirely, dismiss any value in this world. Obviously, you must eat and breathe and drink and sleep and pay your taxes on time. But other than minimal engagement, they have no appetite or no interest in investing in this world. And I remember Rav Lichtenstein using these words, and I'll even tell you the tone he used, because there was an audible part to his teaching when he said something that he felt was very full of conviction. He wanted to convince us and persuade us, because he always spoke in balanced terms. He always gave both sides of the equation, but you knew which position he held. It's not as if he was balancing and holding it up for a toss-up. You knew his position, but he wanted to validate the other position, and so he create inherent or innate balance. He would give one position, and then he would forcibly, almost gutturally say, but this is, and when he said that position, you knew that was his opinion, and that was the one that should be the dominant perspective. He said, in some people, and you know he was talking about himself and his ideology, some people feel that even though it's a passageway, you should take the time to renovate it so that others who come after you could have easier passage. Remember that? Those are the words he said. I found that so powerful. And his tone changed. You should renovate it for those. It was like a very deep, when he spoke with deep moral conviction, his voice changed. He spoke at a different level. He gave a hesped about this a few weeks ago. You can listen to it. I talked about the different voices, the different types of ways he spoke, not just what he said, the content, but just give me a few minutes mentioning. So it's obvious that Olam Hazeh yields Olam Haba through a struggle. Some people, Baruch Hashem, are zocheh to easier lives. Some people are zocheh to more difficult lives. But every religious experience is a struggle. And Rabbi Shimon paralleled two different experiences that we may not think require struggle, we may think are given. But oddly enough, because they're so important metaphysically, they entail a struggle. So let's take a look at what Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai says in the Medrash in Parsha Shmini. Because you would think that these are metaphysically preordained realities. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai Pasach, Amad Vayimodet Eretz. HaKadosh Baruch Hu stood and measured the earth. So it simply means, and Chabakuk is a very celestial sefer. It talks a lot about Hashem and activities in Shemayim. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu measured the earth. Rav Shimon says he measured as a prelude to selection. Hashem made four very important selections. He selected us in the Dor HaMidbar to receive the Torah. He selected Har Sinai to be the mountain which hosted Mountain Torah. He selected Yerushalayim as the city in which the Beis HaMikdash should be constructed and assembled. And of course, he selected Eretz Yisrael. Madar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, line number two, Kol HaUmos, V'lo Matza Uma Sha'isa Ru'uya L'Kabel HaSatara, El HaDor HaMidbar. Which is an important statement, because you would think that we're just the accidental beneficiaries of Avram's selection. Shem selected Avram, we were his grandchildren, and Shem set in motion a historical cycle, and we were just the innocent beneficiaries. Now, HaKadosh Baruch Hu recalibrated. And we really were worthy to receive his Torah. That experience in Egypt wasn't just punitive. It was formative. We came out a different people. We were ready to grasp monotheism. We were sensitive to human suffering. We were sensitive to human abuse because we had been victims of abuse. Hashem saw us as a nation independently. Just like there was no reason he chose Har Sinai. Har Sinai had no ancestors that dictated its selection. For whatever reason, Hashem chose Har Sinai. You all know the famous Medrash, perhaps other reasons. Hashem chose us and rendered us worthy. Hashem chose Eretz Yisrael and Yerushalayim when it came time to build the Beis HaMikdash. So you think all these selections are preordained. And if they're preordained divinely, then history should cooperate. Unfortunately, history isn't cooperating. Rashi sends this in the first Rashi Alatar. Rashi asks what we would call a chutz kasha. It's a strange Rashi. Why does the Torah not begin with a chodesh zeh lachem? That's a preposterous question. There's so much theology in Bereshis. There's so much discussion of how God created the world, moral instruction. Are you willing to dispense with all of Sefer Bereishis? It's a very streamlined way to view the Torah. It's a legal book. There's so many other dimensions to the Torah aside from legality. If it's just a legal code, begin with the first mitzvah, Chodesh Zeh Lachem. The answer is obvious. It's moral, it's theological, it's historical. Rashi says, even putting aside all those considerations, the struggle for Eretz Yisrael is not geopolitical, it's not local, it's not parochial. It's a historical struggle to reassert our presence as HaKadosh Baruch Hu's chosen people and to live in the land He chooses for us. And why do you think there's such stiff opposition, the kind of which you don't experience or you're not encountering in other contested areas of the world? Because subconsciously the nations know this is a historical contest. This is not just about a parcel of land. This is about our stature as Hashem's chosen people and our return and attempts to settle and live in the land He chooses for us. That's why it's such a struggle. Now, it's a struggle at a national level. It used to be a struggle at a personal level. I know when I made Aliyah, it was a very personal struggle because I left a lot behind. And for anyone that made Aliyah in the first two or three decades of the State of Israel, it was a real struggle. Imagine it's reaching the stage in which it's not really so much of a struggle. I'm sure there are a lot of people in this room from Johannesburg who feel like they've been upgraded. They've been upgraded now. Now we now live in a place with less crime, and we live in a functioning government. And I think in general areas it's been upgraded. They just came out with a... since I always have to shame all of you for not coming to my morning shiurim, I always have to mention every week. I talked about this on Monday, the famous Ramban, Parshas Brecha Kosai. When Mashiach comes, Mashiach will introduce an era of universal welfare, human prosperity, and the extension of life expectancy. People won't die, people won't be as sick. So life expectancy has leapt dramatically, precipitously, has augmented over the last 15, 20 years. Life expectancy has skyrocketed. And, astonishingly, which country do you think came in sixth in the index of life expectancy? Our good old country, Israel. So next time people tell you it's not safe to live in Israel, say, I want to live a long time. I beg to differ. It's one of the safest places to live. Life expectancy is number six. Well ahead of good old USA. Well ahead. In which they say there's an average of a shooting of four every day. I just read some statistic. There's on average, on a daily level, there are four people shot at once. Not just four across the... but there are incidents in which four people's lives are lost to gun violence or gun-related violence. And my statistics are off. That's the omen of Gula. How do we know Gula's around the corner? Because people are living longer. Medical advances are extending human life, and Baruch Hashem and Eretz Yisrael, because we value life so deeply, and we preserve the quality of life. Very quietly, Israel has been heroic in trying to save lives across the Syrian border, trying to repair lost lives or crushed lives, very quietly. We can't publicize it because it'd be counterproductive, because then the Arab propaganda machine would seize on this and would ban it or punish the people who take advantage of this opportunity. Very quietly, we're trying our best to protect life in a chaos world in which life is being snatched ruthlessly and mercilessly. So Eretz Yisrael demands a challenge, at least at a national level. And of course, Torah. And I hope that some of you are starting to realize the inherent struggle of Torah. It's a struggle because it's hard, it's difficult, because you're always overmatched, because you're applying the human mind to HaKadosh Baruch Hu's will. I hope you realize only by superhuman effort will you really achieve success in Torah. And not to take it lightly, and not to opt out because you're tired, or to acquit yourself because you're not feeling well, but to push yourself in the study of Torah. And that's really corresponding to the first Rashi in Parshas Bechukosai. We'll get to this later if we have some time. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is Mizaveh Shetu Amei L'Matara. Hashem covets that people work hard in Torah. One of the great legacies of Rav Lichtenstein, and there's so many great legacies, is we saw a Masmid. We saw someone that worked in Torah from a different era almost. It's almost as if it doesn't exist today, because we've grown up in cultures of convenience, in cultures of relaxed experience, chilled experience. Where are Australians in the room? You know, they can attest to an entire culture built on chillaxing and relaxing and not being worried and that, right? So not worrying about tomorrow and introducing a healthy strain and a healthy coiled tension and a striving for achievement. One of the most interesting questions I faced on my recent round of trips to the United States, in which I spoke to adults about Rav Lichtenstein, I also spoke to high school kids. And a high school boy, I won't divulge his name, I won't embarrass him, after my describing Rav Lichtenstein and delivering a shiur, and I opened the floor for questions, he said, "Tell me, Rabbi Tarragon, were you ever depressed by chasing Rav Lichtenstein's standard and knowing you'd never reach it?" So that was a great, great question, because the standard was so elusive, so surpassing, so challenging, that at points you could have easily fallen into despair. And part of the answer was, that's where Rav Amital came in. Rav Amital was just very grounded, very, I say this in the right way, very normal, so to speak, in a way that Rav Lichtenstein was not normal, because his achievements and his drive and his behavior was superhuman. And when I remember this very clearly, when I used to introduce myself at parent and student meetings when I would canvas and recruit and interview for the yeshiva, so I would say, one of the reasons I feel, which is, this is an anecdote to an anecdote, because I got an email from someone, he's a middle-aged man, I don't know how old he is because I've never met him, but he said, he listened to some of my conversations about Rav Lichtenstein and some of the other people who spoke about Rav Lichtenstein, and now looking back, one of his greatest regrets is that he never had a chance to meet and understand and appreciate this person. And why it resonated within me, because when I used to talk to boys in 1997 or 2003 or 2007 about coming to the yeshiva, I used to say, here's your chance. I can't tell you if the Gush is the right yeshiva for you. You have to check whether it stacks up on the X's and O's, the program, the boys. But if this is the place for you, this is a chance to have two life-altering personalities in your life. People that have changed. These are Gedolim. The people with Gedolim in their lives are fundamentally different than people without Gedolim. It's a fundamental difference as to how you're raised and how you experience religion and education. I said, please don't pass up this experience. Don't pass it up lightly. Think very carefully about that X factor beyond just where the beds are more comfortable and where your friends are going. And some boys listen, some boys didn't listen. And here's someone who evidently didn't listen. I don't think I ever met him. I think probably before my time as an educator in yeshiva as a tester. But it just struck a chord in me because that's something I was very desperate to expose as many people as I could while they were alive to these two great people. So I used to introduce my conversations when I would have a parlor meeting for students or for parents, and I would say, Rav Lichtenstein challenges us to be like angels. And Rav Amital reminds us that it's okay to be human beings. And we always felt that balance, as if Rav Aaron was striving on his own experience and was pushing us, in our experience, to transcend ourselves. Because that was the image he set. And Rav Amital was that comforting assurance that even when we failed, we still had validity and we still were of the Hashem. I also answered this point that Rav Lichtenstein was just a very positive person. So as stark as his example was and as challenging, you just felt embraced by his positivism. He's just a very, very positive person. So you couldn't imagine him ever critiquing you harshly about your failures. As much as he strove for excellence, as whatever standards he demanded of himself, you felt very embraced not on a personal level. He wasn't warm and charismatic in that sense, but he valued human beings. And he's the most respectful person I've ever met in his ability to value other people and respect their perspectives. So this is what Rabbi Shimon said. There are three experiences which are demanding. One is Torah, one is Eretz Yisrael, and one is Olam Haba. Shlosh Devarim Niknu B'Yisur. Now it's interesting that he aligned Eretz Yisrael and Olam Haba. For all of those who are searching for an easy way out of Eretz Yisrael, let's read about what he told his Talmidim. Turn to the back page. It's a Medrash in Parshas Pekudei, the top of the back page. Medrash says, Maisa B'Talmud Echad. Oh, okay, I'm sorry. For you, it's going to be on that separate page. The top of the page says Shemos. There's no title to it. You should all have three pages. Who doesn't have three pages? Okay, the extra page is in there, Yili. This is a story about one of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's Talmidim who went to Chutz Laaretz to make money. He went to, right, so now you're missing a, okay, you've got the right thing. He went to Chutz Laaretz to make a lot of moolah, to make a lot of money. And he came back with his iPhone, and he came back with his fancy car, and all of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's students became jealous. Maybe we should go to Chutz Laaretz as well. So Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai found out, and he intervened. He took them out to some valley called Pagei Madon. Nispalel, and he asked for supernatural intervention. The Amar, Bika, Bika, valley, Mil'ei Din Rei Zahav, I want you to become saturated with gold coins. Hitchila Moshechas Din Rei Zahav Lefnehem. Here's your gold, he told them. Amar Lahem, there's a devil's deal, he's making a deal with them. Line number three, Im Zahavatem Mevakshim, Harei Zahav. Tlumachem, take your gold. Elahayu Yodim, kol mishu notel achshav, chelko shel olam habahu notel. You want the gold, it's going to cost you. It will cost you your eternity. Make a wise choice. Every ducat you pick up, every gold sack you pick up, you'll deplete your olam haba. Make a choice. She'ein matan tzchar hatara el li'olam haba. Vatischak. Yom Acharon. Have that vision for the Yom Acharon. So Rabbi Shimon was obviously issuing two statements at one. Number one, about the transitory value of affluence and wealth and the more important and immortal value of Olam Haba. But it was also couched within living in Eretz Yisrael. It wasn't just that the student came by wealth in Israel. He had to leave Israel because at that time, at least naturally, Israel wasn't a wealth-producing country. It wasn't a country of great wealth. It was very socioeconomically depressed after the Chorban Beis HaMikdash and in the years leading up to the Chorban Beis HaMikdash. So he was not just reminding them about the dangers of greed and avarice and financial infatuation, or infatuation with gold, but also warning them that sometimes living in Eretz Israel demands that you forego some material pleasure. And the student who went to Chutz Laaretz and became wealthy, perhaps was forgotten some of his schar. So Rabbi Shimon was very adamant in reminding his Talmidim of the struggle for Eretz Yisrael and of deferring their expected rewards for Olam Haba. Let's turn the page back and see something else Rabbi Shimon said. Rabbi Shimon, and sometimes people make this mistake, because Rabbi Shimon, certainly in the story we just read, sounds very harsh tones, comes across as very, one would say, fanatical. Well, sometimes, and listen carefully to what I'm about to say, maybe let me frame it, okay? We're in the process of celebrating Yom HaTzmaut and Yom Yerushalayim, Mirat Hashem, in a few weeks, 2 weeks, a week and a half. Do you know who one of the greatest lovers of the Jewish people over the last century was? An ardent opposer of the entire Zionist movement, what anyone would call, someone who anyone would call a fanatic. That's how harsh his opposition to Zionism was. His name was Rabbi Yoel Teitelbaum, and he was a Satmar Rebbe. Legendary in his fierce, ferocious disapproval of Zionism. He wasn't an opponent, he was a detractor. He mocked it. He lashed out at it. He saw it just to shake you up and horrify you. He saw this as the cause of the Holocaust. In as many words, the Holocaust was divinely imposed because of the Zionist movement. This is HaKadosh Baruch Hu punishing the Jewish people for violating the terms of history. Without getting into the details now. My hair standing on my neck to think of such a blood-curdling statement. Such a horrific statement. Big Talmud Chacham. But also, legendary Ohr of Yisrael. Legendary Ohr of Yisrael. If you walk in Mea Shearim and a chassid says something nasty to you, it could very well be. It doesn't have to be. Not in every instance. It's because he really loves you and cares for you and cares for your common faith. Western civilization is built on privacy and keep to yourself and to each his own, and you have your own home and don't invade my privacy. What are my rights? The consequence of that is a socially fissured, unraveled fabric. What is a social fabric? What, do you feel any common thread that unites all the citizens of South Africa? Common thread that unites all the citizens? A columnist I enjoy reading called David Brooks, a New York Times columnist, wrote an article because everyone in America is now searching for the post-Trumpian remedy. Because Trump has put his finger on the pulse of some growing dissatisfaction with the American experiment, the American experience. So hopefully this man won't get elected, but what's next? He obviously has awakened the Dybbuk. He obviously has let the genie out of the bottle. People are dissatisfied. So David Brooks came up with this brilliant novel idea. National service. National service is a unifier. You can't build a country that's unified because everyone wants iPhone 6 or something. That's not an ethic that's going to unite people. It's to be an ethic. What do we believe in? What do we want to sacrifice for? Belief is a product of sacrifice. You sacrifice convenience and luxury, personal interest, for something that's an ideal, that's something that's a value. We share that value, then we're bonded around that value. National service. I wonder which country in the world uses national service as a social unifier. You're sitting in that country. We've known that for years. The army doesn't need you. The army has plenty of manpower. The army has become a social unifier. Living together. From non from Dati, Chiloni, Ashkenazi, Mizrahi, rich, poor, Olim, New Olim, not Olim. And that's why Baruch Hashem, living in this country, gives you such a powerful sense of fraternity and national identity. Because we have that unifying fabric. So sometimes when people care, now ideally they should express their care and affection and respect and kindness. Sometimes they're not able to because they care too deeply. Why do you think sometimes family relationships are so fraught with tension and hostility and animosity? Because if I act in a way that disappoints you, I'm not part of your orbit. But if you're a child or your sibling or your parent, at some level you care more about them than you care about strangers. And if their behavior isn't in line with your expectations, isn't symmetrical with your desires, it really bothers you. It's irritating in a way that isn't to the foreigner. So sometimes fanaticism is really just an expression of misexpressed or poorly expressed or inordinately expressed, imbalanced expression of care. And to me, the Satmar Rebbe is, I'm not judging him or profiling him because he's too big a Talmud Chacham and I don't know him well enough, but from a distance it appears that it was that combination of caring so much and having a particular ideological opinion and expressing it in ways that we may find strident or we may find judgmental. One could claim similarly about Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, who strikes that strident chord sometimes. But then you read how caring and loving he was about the fact that Hashem chose us. Or, as Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai says, look at paragraph number 3 on the first page, the first side of the first page. Bo re'e kama chavivin Yisrael lefnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Now remember, Shimon bar Yochai is living at a very important juncture in time. This is when the Jews are about to start the long night of Golus. So he reminds them that despite your departure and despite your exile, you're not the only ones walking out of Israel. You've got a divine escort. Hashem is with you wherever you are. When you leave, he leaves. Shebachol Makom, line number 2, the third paragraph. Shegalu Shechina Imahem. Galu Limitzayim Shechina Imahem. Shenemar Haniglo Niglesi Leves Avicha. Galu Lebavel Shechina Imahem. Shenemar Lemanchem Shulachti Bavela. I was sent to Bavel with you. The Yaf, line number 3 from the bottom. Kishin asidim ligayal, when we will one day be redeemed, look around you. Shechina imam, Hashem's Shechina is being redeemed. Shenemar, you all know this pasuk, it's Parshas Nitzavim. Vishav Hashem, es shivuscha. What should the pasuk really write? Who knows their grammar? Not Vishav Hashem, but Veheshiv Hashem et shivutcha. Hashem will draw you back. Doesn't say Veheshiv Vishav. Vishav means he will return. Vishav uvanim. We have to sing Vishav uvanim for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Vishav uvanim, Vishav u'melech. Because as the Jewish people have returned, not just geographically, but in stature. I didn't get a chance to speak with you before Yom HaTzmaut, but one of the lessons that Rav Amital taught us repeatedly on Yom HaTzmaut, and those were legendary sichot. Rav Amital would give 6 or 7 legendary sichot in which you literally felt your mind and your identity being shaped. He would speak the first night of Slichos. He would speak each day of Rosh Hashanah before Musaf. He would speak Yom Kippur before Ne'ilah. Earth-shattering speeches. And then he would speak Chanukah, which was the time he arrived in Israel, the third night of Chanukah, and talk about his own personal experience sometimes and the value of Jewish sovereignty. Then he would speak Yom HaTzmaut, and sometimes Yom Yerushalayim, but not always. And these were foundational speeches. He didn't just get up and give a pshat, oh, I heard a pshat so-and-so. These were manifestos. And they were all online. You can read them. Well, these were, what does it mean to have sovereignty? What does the state mean to us? How do we dive with HaKadosh Baruch Hu? What is the symbolism of the Akedah? Basic tenets of Judaism. And Rav Amital refused the following simple equation. He refused to simply package the Holocaust into the state of Israel. He thought that was disrespect to the victims and intellectual impoverished or intellectual ignorance. You can't wrap the human mind around the Holocaust. It's too large for simple solutions. There is no solution. It's beyond human understanding. The Holocaust is too large. And those of you who went to Poland, you saw this. Those of you who will go to Poland, just for the sake of those who went to Poland already, or those, you can even think about who are going. When I took the group to Poland and I wanted to help them imagine 6 million, because the number was important to quantify because we needed to know. But unfortunately, that's become a cliche. 6 million, 6 million. You say it so often, it loses any meaning. So one day when we traveled, we had a long trip. I think one day we had to travel like 10 hours or something. So I told the boys, I want you to look outside the bus and imagine that there are people lining the shoulder of the road, standing literally, not back to back, but standing tightly packed. And I'll tell you when we hit 6 million, based on our speed and based on the area coverage. I did a quick math equation. And it was something like 10 hours and 15 minutes into the trip. So can you imagine traveling on a bus? Imagine this long road. Traveling on a bus for 10 hours in a car for 60 minutes. 10 hours, 60 miles an hour or whatever, 120 kilometers. And you're just passing endless stacks of people for hours and hours and hours. And that's 6 million people die. That's just to make it more concrete. Unless something that hides behind the numerical cliche. But one thing Rav Amital told us, that the Holocaust wasn't just an attack on Jews, but the fallen and sullen state of Jewry in the 1940s represented the greatest Chilul Hashem since the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash. And that HaKadosh Baruch Hu almost was forced to intervene and restore some of the lost luster of Hashem's name. Hashem had to restore Kiddush Hashem in light of that Chilul Hashem. It's almost as if Hashem didn't have a choice. You can't ignore the juxtaposition with the state of Israel and the Holocaust. It's simply undeniable. It's so powerful and so obvious. Not God forbid that Hashem repaid us and God forbid it was worth it or one created the other, but there's clearly a dynamic, there's clearly a transition of HaKadosh Baruch Hu restoring, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu is represented in this world by the Jewish people. And when we're in Galus, He's in Galus, physically, spiritually, supernaturally, but also His presence recedes because the Jewish people have suffered so much. And Baruch Hashem, with the emergence of the State of Israel, not just a geographic return, but we're becoming a world power in almost every sphere, militarily, economically, health, technology, science, culture, because we're His people. And all these growths are a representation of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's newly regenerated luster, a newly regenerated presence in this world. And if terrorists are trying to hijack HaKadosh Baruch Hu's name, and trying to present him as a God of hatred and a God of evil and a God of suffering. And we're broadcasting a very different message to humanity. We're broadcasting a message of monotheism, of peace and harmony, and human welfare, and science, and ration, and respect of life. And that's really the struggle. I want you to realize you're part of the struggle also. You may not be carrying a rifle, may not be fighting in Iraq, may not yet be in the Tzal, but you're part of that struggle wherever you are to wear religion in a modern milieu in which it's being recast through distortion and perversion. And you have to wear religion the right way. That's why it's so urgent and so critical that you be deeply religious people who identify as religious, but are able to radiate religion in a way that some people don't often encounter in a world of commotion, chaos, death, violence associated with or perpetrated in the name of religion. So this is Rabbi Shimon saying, Kama Chavivin Yisrael, Kama Chavivin Yisrael, Shechina Imayim. And he didn't just say, Kama Chavivin Yisrael, Shechina Imayim, but he said something which some of you will find a little bit awkward. But let me tell you what Rabbi Shimon felt, and let me try to open your minds a little bit. Second to last paragraph on the first page. Amar Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, Kol ha'ozer es Yisrael. Okay. All the politicians who support Israel out there, hope they're listening to this year. All those who help the Jewish people, ki'ilu ozer es hashchina, they're really helping HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And he quotes the pasuk. Shekol ha'ozer li'Yisrael, quotes the pasuk in Shoftim. Shiras Devara. Ozer es hashchina. Who knows what types of events were introduced by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in part at least, so that they would help rebuild the Jewish constitution and the Jewish identity, thereby helping the Shechina. So Kobe, you're going to get angry with me about this. Who knows, just by way of hyperbole, just to shock your imagination, if the entire American Revolution in 1776 was introduced by HaKadosh Baruch Hu so that 200 years later, the United States could be instrumental in defeating Nazism and instrumental in helping rebuild Israel and rebuild our world. Wow, if anyone's listening to this, they would be very I'm folding 200 years of American history, the richness, the depth, the accomplishments, just so that they can help the Jewish people. It's not about playing God. But Shimon bar Yochai is certainly sensing that. And what's more important, to build a country and a people, or to help bring the Shechina into our world? Kol ha'ozer li'Yisrael, kilu ozer l'Shechina. That wouldn't be an asinine or vapid statement if HaKadosh Baruch Hu creates certain events so that hundreds of years later they can help the Shechina. That would be perfectly natural, metaphysically. He didn't create the United States for hot dogs. He created the United States for sports. He created the United States so that his Shechina should be more felt, should be more present. And part of that is obviously there are values that certain countries represent. Freedom, liberty, democracy, morality. But part of it is parochial, making sure that the Jewish people can return to their land and represent the Shechina. So this position of Rav Shimon bar Yochai actually got him into hot water. And now let's get to the most famous story about Rav Shimon bar Yochai. Because there was a conversation which took place. And you could pick up on this conversation on the back of, well, for you, it's the second paragraph of the page that starts with Shmos. What happened? Pasach Rabbi Yehuda, line 3. This is a Gemara in Shabbos. And Rabbi Yehuda, very interesting person himself, said, line 3, very famous Gemara in Shabbos, Kama na'im ma'aseim shel umazu. He was flattering. He was applauding the Romans. He was commending the Romans. Tiknu shivakim. They built marketplaces, malls. Tiknu gisharim, suspension bridges. Not really. Tiknu merchatzos, bathhouses, public hygiene. So Yehuda actually felt that they should be given their proper credit, their proper due. Rabbi Yossi Shasak. Rabbi Yossi was quiet. What did Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai say? Kol ma shetiknu, lo tiknu ela letzarech atzman. They only constructed bridges, bathhouses, and markets for their own interest. Two different views of non-Jewish progress. This is non-Jewish progress. The Jews were subdued. The Jews couldn't build bridges, markets, and bathhouses. The Romans built them. The Jews obviously at some level were beneficiaries. They crossed the bridges. They shopped in the markets. Are they to be blamed for building markets for their own interests? I mean, it's part of progress, part of advance. Where Rav Shimon Bar Yochai sensed something a little more criminal. He wasn't just opposed to the markets and the bathhouses because the motives weren't to serve the Jewish people. That would be acceptable to Rav Shimon Bar Yochai. But there was a distinct immoral, there was a distinct unethical motivation. He said, Tiknu Shivakim, line number 5, the reason they really built the markets is Lahoshiv Bahem Zonos, for sexual promiscuity. Merchatzos, bathhouses, for hedonistic indulgence. Liadein Bahem, not just for public health. Ksharim, Litol Mehen Meches. See, there's only one New Yorker here. Tzvi, tell everyone, if you want to travel from Elizabeth, New Jersey, to New York City, to Staten Island, and a bridge, how much will it set you back?
$16, something like
that. Set you back close, I think, in that razor, close to 100 shekel, just to travel 45 minutes in your car. Next time you complain about taxation, think about what New Yorkers have to go to. 100 shekel just to travel 30 minutes in your car, not including gas. They just want to collect taxes and tolls. So by the way, just so you should see, there isn't one view in Chazal. If Yehuda was able to process Roman endeavors and Roman progress in a positive fashion, and I don't think they disagreed about the facts, they both understood that at some level they were interested in prostitution and hedonism and overtaxation. But that's natural to the human condition. There's also, not everyone's motivation is always pure. And motivation is not always unidimensional. Sometimes it's complex. Sometimes it's multidimensional. Some people are interested in the zonos. Some people are interested just in providing public services. Some people are interested in exploiting others through tax. Some people are just interested in public welfare. But Rav Shimon Bar Yochai was opposed because he sensed this wasn't to help the Jewish people. And he had just said before that whoever helps the Jewish people is helping the Shechina. And this didn't accord with that profile. So there was someone eavesdropping. Does anyone know the name of the person eavesdropping? Yehuda ben Gerim. Interesting name. Sounds like he was a convert. Yehuda ben Gerim was listening. Gotta watch these converts. You never know. Yehuda ben Gerim was listening, and he told the Romans about this conversation. So of course, Yehuda She'ila Yisala, Rabbi Yehuda became a very respected Roman personality, not Roman, but he was very respected by the Romans. He was called Rosh HaMedabrim. Whenever there was a public gathering, he was always given the floor first to honor his respect for the Roman Empire. Rabbi Yossi, he was quiet, so his response was, as we would say, lethargic, non-committal, neutral. So they didn't punish him, but they forced him to leave Yerushalayim. Where did Tanaim go when things got hot in Yerushalayim? Who knows there? North. Tzipori. Very good. He went to Tzipori. Which Tana was most affiliated with the northern part of Israel? Rabbi Yossi HaGalili. He was called Rabbi Yossi of Galil. But they all ran this. I saw many of the burials are there. So many of the kevers, the kvarim are there. Meron, people are traveling to Meron tonight by the millions, not millions, but hundreds of thousands. Up north, more or less, there at Tzvan. And Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who had belittled the Roman Empire, who had disparaged the Roman Empire, a bounty was put out on his head. So what do you do when a bounty's on your head? You go to Beis Medrash. So he took his son, he went to the Beis Medrash, Elazar, and they sat learning. But the Romans were chasing them too fervently. And they knew that they would be captured. So when the Beis Medrash can no longer provide refuge, they found a cave. And they spent 13 years together under very sparse conditions, eating charuvin, eating cherub trees, drinking water. Their body became filled of hives and corns and whatever else happens to your body when you don't attend to it hygienically without bathing. Very harsh conditions. How do you think Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai became a Talmid Chacham? He spent 12 years learning to be a kiva and 13 years in a cave. You all become a Talmid Chacham by learning a little and taking a break. Or going to a yeshiva for a year and Moving on. Get on with your life. Want to get on with your life. Well, if you want to be a Talmid Chacham, that is not the recipe. You've got to spend time. You've got to put in your time. You've got to clock your time. And then at some point, let's pick up the story. Line number 7 of the second paragraph. They heard that the decree had been rescinded. Nafgu, they came out of the cave. Chazu inji de kakarbi vizari. What's the first thing they saw? People were planting and plowing. Amar, Rabbi Shimon was so distraught. Manichim chaye olam ve'oskim b'chaye shah. They're ignoring eternity for transience, for fleeting. It reminds me of my students, he says, before the cave, who were addicted to gold. Here they're plowing and planting. Tara mate Allah. Well, tonight when you're dancing around the fire for Shirin Bar Yochai, remember his famous machlokas with Rabbi Yishmael. We'll take a quick break from this Gemara and we'll turn to a different Gemara. A famous Gemara, another famous Gemara in Brachas Lamed Hei, which is the back part of your double-sided Rabbi Shirin Bar Yochai page. What does the Torah say? V'yasafta diganecha. You'll say this in an hour. Literally, in an hour from now, you'll be saying 8:05. V'yasafta diganecha. V'tiroshcha v'yitzerecha. Sounds like you should be a lawyer. Sounds like you should be a doctor. Sounds like you should be an engineer. Sounds like you should be a rabbi rather than learning all day. You should have a profession. That's not what we're saying by Yochai felt. Tana Rabbanan, line number 4. V'yasafta diganecha. On the other hand, the Torah says you should learn every minute. If we just had the pasuk of Layamash Sefer Atarah Zemi Picha, you'd think you learn all day. Rabbi Yishmael says, Tamil Lamar Viasafta Diganacha. Rabbi Yishmael says, Haneg Minag Derech Eretz. Follow the way of the world. People work, you work. People plow, you plow. People plant, you plant. So said Rabbi Yishmael. So didn't say Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai Omer, Efshar, line number 7, Adam Choresh B'Shas Charisha, Zorea B'Shas Zeria. Those of you who learn Shabbos next year, this is a nice introduction to the beginning of Shabbos. Charisha Zeria, Kotzer B'Shas Kitzira, Dash B'Shas Disha, Zorea B'Shas Haruach. 4 haunting words. Are you listening? Tara, Ma, Tehe, Aleha, who is going to carry Torah? If our best and brightest become high-powered, fill in the blanks, and don't become teachers of Torah, who will carry Torah? Who will carry Torah? I want to speak to the South Africans here in particular. We are thrilled with this year. This is our best year. Okay, some of you asked them. I just had a conversation with the Rebbeim. The MTA this year is fantastic. In part, because of a young leadership of Torah that invested in you guys back home. And I'm telling you this honest to goodness, some of those men who taught you Torah sat in this room listening to me say 10 years ago, who's going to carry Torah? Rabbi Kaplan sat in this room. Rabbi Bernstein sat in this room. Rabbi Kagan sat in this room. So now it's 10 years after they sat, and you're their products, and you're sitting in this room. And the same with everyone else in this room, because Baruch Hashem, we've all had teachers that sat in this room and heard that message, whether this room in particular. So now who's going to be the next one? Tara Matei Aleha. Don't just allow someone else to do your dirty work. Not that it's dirty, but there's something important to be done. Do it yourself. So Rabbi Shimon said, Ella, line number 5 from the bottom, Bizman shi Yisrael osim ritzano shel makom, when the Jews study Torah with all their might, melachtam nasis aide acherim. You can rely on other people to support you, and it will happen supernaturally. Next time someone ranks on Kolel, you say, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai was Mr. Kolel. You have every moral right, both personally as well as nationally. Does anyone in this room have a shadow of a doubt that if tomorrow the entire country of Israel, 6.5 million strong, all became dati and all put on tefillin and all kept Shabbos and all studied Torah, of course Mashiach would come. Of course that's the best solution for all of our political and military struggles. In a second, if I could flip the switch, I would give away all of our guns and tanks, and in a second, we could rely. But that's not really practical, because we're unable to turn people's hearts. We're trying. But when Am Yisrael studies, Bizman She'en Yisrael Osim Mitzvah Shomakom, Melachtam Nasasai De Atzmon, She'nem Ravi Asafta Diganecha. So Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, his professional guidance was to study Torah all day. Now, a little bit of a footnote, take a look at the end of the Gemara. Amar Abaye, Abaye who lived 200 years later, says, Harbe Asur Krebi Yishmael Va'osu V'yadam. Many people tried Rebbe Yishmael's formula and they succeeded. Harbe Asur Krebi Shimon Va'osu V'yadam. Many people tried Rebbe Shimon's strategy and they didn't succeed because it's hard. It's hard. I'm eavesdropping a lot on a lot of conversations about the Haredim this and the Haredim that, and certainly all legitimate conversations. But to lead a real Haredi lifestyle, at least in the state of Israel, what's a real Haredi lifestyle is to subject yourself to a life of poverty, willfully. So you're going to live in a small apartment, have a large family, not really have financial means. You can argue about it ideologically, morally, culturally, across the board, the legitimate conversations, but you should be in awe of that decision. Who in this room is willing to even reduce their level of affluence for an ideal? Well, I could have become a businessman, but I feel like a doctor is more idealistic. So I'll earn a little bit less, but most doctors earn healthy, robust salaries. Educators earn salaries. You may not be able to afford nice new cars, but you're able to drive from point X to point Y and put food in your stomach. And here you've got people that willfully submit themselves to lack of occupation. You can argue it's not fair, it's not morally fair, it's not wise. I'm no way clocking in with an opinion. I'm just shining a spotlight on one aspect of their personality. But it's hard. And it's worthy of our emulation. And worthy of our exporting into our own world and adjusting it, but not making decisions solely on financial remuneration and financial well-being, making decisions based on values and conviction. So getting back to that Gemara and Shabbos, Rabbi Shimon was horrified when he exited the cave and he saw people listening to Rabbi Yishma, basically sowing, planting, and harvesting. So who knows the Gemara and Shabbos? What did he do next?
Burn the field and the guy.
He burned people, incinerated them. At which point, Abascal came out and said, effectively, I didn't call you out of the cave to burn my children. Let's read the language. Yatza Baskol, line number 9. V'amra lahem, la'achariv olami yatzasem. You've left the cave to annihilate my world. Chizru limaraschem. Go back into the cave. So they spend another year there. Because mishpat rishayim begehenim, this is their gehenim, the Gemara says. They have to suffer because of their crime. And then they exit the cave. And now Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and his son Rabbi Elazar see the same scene unfolding, but the elder statesman Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is able to absorb this shock and allow people to have different standards than he holds himself to. It's a very, very important balance. Challenge yourself and hold yourself to high standards. But be willing to tolerate and celebrate people who don't or are unable to reach those standards as well. Very often people are tolerant of lower standards, but that toleration or that tolerance begins to erode their own standards. And other people of high standards are very judgmental and unaccepting of others. Listen carefully to what I'm about to say. We typically judge ourselves by our potential and we judge others by their performance. Which is why we have a very favorable judgment of ourselves, because we have a lot of potentials, everyone does, and a very harsh judgment of others. If you can invert that, you'll be more healthy morally. Judge yourself by your achievements, and when your achievements fail to reach your expectations, catch yourself, call yourself, correct yourself. Don't discount yourself, don't acquit yourself easily. And when you see others, see them favorably by their potential. And Rabbi Shimon was able to transition from a harsh judgmentalist into a tolerant, we will call Rebbe. his son Reb Elazar was not. And his son was about to do the incinerating thing. He was about to incinerate someone. And what happened? Mahadi Panya Damali Shabta, six lines from the bottom, was Erev Shabbos. Chazahu Saba, the Havinakatre Medani Asad. He saw an old man. They saw an old man carrying two sticks of hadassim, five lines from the bottom. Virait Beinash Mashas, and he was running. Erev Shabbos. Amrule, they asked this old man, hadassim man, Mahanach Lamalach, why do you have two hadassim? Amalo, he told them, Lechvot Shabbos. Tiski Lecha Bechad, one is enough. He said, Chad Kineged Zachar, Chad Kineged Shamar, I'm going to bring home one hadas stick for Zachar, one hadas stick for Shamar. Anyone know what this is the source of? A minimum of two, one for Zachar, one for Shamar. Shabbos candles. Shabbos candles. This is why the minimum is two. People have a minhag to light a candle for each person in their family, other symbolic counts. But the minimum, if you're traveling, take two candles. You don't light one candle. Two candles is the minimum for Shabbos. When you go to with one candle, the minhag is two candles. Zachar v'shamar.
Even if you're traveling by yourself?
Yep. Take two candles. Little tea lights. No problem today. Two candles. Zachar v'shamar. And somehow they saw this old man, and just seeing the way he, this simple man, this villager, this farmer, just celebrated Shabbos. He wasn't a big Talmud Chacham. He couldn't quote Tzotzos and Nesivos. He couldn't speak with them about Kabbalah. That love that he felt for the Jewish people resurfaced. That was reaffirmed. They may not be big tzaddikim in the classic sense that I expect for myself and my son. They may not be cavemen, but they just celebrate Shabbos. And have a love for Shabbos, and this old man is running by. Of all the people to placate Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's ire, it wasn't a colleague, it wasn't his Rebbe Rabbi Akiva, it wasn't his Talmud Rabbi Yehuda. Who placated him? A simple old man celebrating Shabbos and trying to bring home some air freshener for his home, bring home hadassim sticks. So I guess the best way to summarize Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, we didn't get a chance to move on to B'chakosai, but the best way to celebrate Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is as follows. Number one, his love for people, Torah, and land. His commitment to Torah, land, Eretz Yisrael, people, Kama Chaviv in Yisrael. That trifecta we're trying so hard to ingrain in you. How do you balance those three? It's complex. If you really love Torah, then you care about people who don't study Torah. But if you care too much about people who don't study Torah, you become judgmental and dismissive of them, and then you're challenged to love them as they are. He lived through a very difficult time to be in Eretz Yisrael. Baruch Hashem, he remained in Eretz Yisrael. He probably traveled to Rome after the cave incident, but he was buried in Meron, and people are going to be visiting his grave tonight. Most importantly, like all of Chazal, he's a complex thinker, and his sayings are complex, and you can't bottle and reduce him to one single statement. And don't make that mistake when you read Chazal, as if Chazal had one train of thought, one dimension of opinion. They were rich, complex people. They were a unique group of people. They said our Masara. They lived in close proximity to Har Sinai. They lived right after the period of prophecy, and that's why we're so deferential to them. Shimon Bar Yochai was one of the standout members of this group of people, and some of his sayings reflect the complexity by which he processed a world which was changing rapidly from the Roman world to the post-Roman world of exile, which we're now finally recovering from. So everyone have a great, great Lag BaOmer. And think about some of Shimon Bar Yochai tonight when you see that fire leaping up into the sky. Think about Shimon Bar Yochai in the cave and how much his dedication to Torah was. Have a great Lag BaOmer. Anyone, let me find out whose phone this is. That's an S5. I know whose phone. Let's see if it has a dimension.
Hello.
Are you guys having